Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, July 20th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital, thanking the entire Saratoga community for the extra effort to follow all the necessary precautions to keep everyone safe. Saratoga Hospital, people you trust, care you deserve. Joining us for Medical Monday today is psychiatrist Dr. Joseph DeLulo of the Samaritan Hospital Outpatient Behavioral Health Clinic in Troy. If you would like a question to be posed to Dr. DeLulo, give us a call, 800-348-2551. You can pose your own question, 800-348-2551, or email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. DeLulo and your psychiatry questions coming up after the news. Hi, once again, welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Dr. Joseph DeLulo is a psychiatrist at the Samaritan Hospital Outpatient Behavioral Health Clinic in Troy. He is board certified in psychiatry and geriatric psychiatry. He attended med school at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine and completed his residency in psychiatry and fellowship in geriatric psychiatry at North Shore Long Island Jewish Health System. He treats mental illnesses, including mood, anxiety, psychotic, substance, and personality disorders. If you have a question for Dr. DeLulo today, give us a call, 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, our number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Joseph DeLulo, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Ray. Very good to be here.
All right, this is only based on my observation and my observational evidence, and no science behind this question at all. But I thought you might weigh in on this. In my lifetime, I have never seen a sort of collective, long-term ratcheting of stress in a society as I have in the last 4 months. Has anxiety increased since the nationwide lockdown began?
Unfortunately, I think your observations are completely accurate. And I think it'd be hard to argue that we haven't seen exactly that happen, not only locally, but nationally, and of course, globally. Probably the last time I think, anxiety collectively was this high was probably during World War II or other, major national struggles. But again, I completely agree. Unfortunately, that is clearly seeming to be the case.
And your job becomes doubly important in times like this. How is this anxiety manifesting itself for the most part?
Well, I think initially, during the first weeks of the quarantines, what we noticed was that people were just worried about what was going to happen with their therapies, whether it be psychotherapy or, medications, and what was going to happen with their appointments. How accessible were healthcare providers going to be, both social workers, clinicians, mental health counselors, and their psychiatrists or psychiatric nurse practitioners and other providers. And it was the uncertainty of the whole circumstance that I think was most destabilizing for a certain number of certain percentage of people.
Dr. Joseph DeLulo joins us today. He is a psychiatrist at the Samaritan Hospital Outpatient Behavioral Health Clinic in Troy. We have talked to doctors over the course of this pandemic and this lockdown. And one thing doctors have learned or are learning is how to effectively do remote visits. And some disciplines, it works better than others. I would imagine, and again, this is only my observation, wouldn't psychiatry lend itself very well to a sort of a WebEx sort of model?
Thankfully, that has been the case, even for the most part in my practice here at the hospital. We've been doing primarily phone calls, and even that alone has been certainly much more beneficial than not being able to have had any appointments at all. I would say because psychiatry and psychotherapy are conversational in nature in terms of treatments, definitely we're able to, I think, we've been able to weather the storm perhaps a little bit better than perhaps other disciplines in medicine that require more hands-on physical exams, et cetera. So I think it is a good point. It's true.
Dr. Joseph DeLulo is on the program today, and he is a psychiatrist at Samaritan Hospital Outpatient Behavioral Health Clinic in Troy. A couple of emails here, doctor, and then we'll take a quick break.
Sure.
And then we will go to the phones. 800-348-2551 if you want to call in. This email came in from Karen, and Karen says, I've been dealing with major treatment-resistant depression for decades. The latest treatment has been ECT, which has caused great memory loss and cognitive issues. What are current and recommended approaches to treatment-resistant depression? And then two, how is esketamine different than ketamine treatments? And I don't know what half of those words mean, but you can help us.
First of all, that's a really, really important question in psychiatry and medicine, and I thank the writer for her question, because treatment-resistant depression has been something that has been really plaguing millions of people across the world in terms of having tried many different treatments and seeming to never have complete or even at times partial remission. So ECT, as she had had mentioned that she had gotten the electroconvulsive therapy, is actually one of the gold standards, if not the gold standard, for depression. Doesn't even have to necessarily be treatment resistant, but it is reserved because of the nature of the delivery of that treatment, that therapy, which involves anesthesia and inducing very controlled seizures. Unfortunately for the listener, the memory lapses are not exceedingly common, but they can occur, and the nature of them can vary. So it also does depend on the type of ECT that was done, whether the leads were placed bilaterally, unilaterally, frontotemporally, just to mention a couple of different locations on the skull that they can be placed. And unfortunately, it does not work for everyone, but it can be effective for up to 60%. That's 60% of treatment-resistant cases of depression.
Do we know why?
They don't, product information statements for most medications, the description is usually stating that we don't know the exact mechanism of the efficacy, the route of efficacy, but there's beliefs that it does reestablish a new equilibrium within the brain, but specifically, it's pretty hard to identify the actual specific nuances of the changes within the brain that have caused it to generally have such a high success rate. Sometimes there are some medications that might become more effective after having had that, but basically the process induces, like I said, controlled seizures. Now, regarding, though, getting back to the also question at hand, the new developments with ketamine are particularly to deal with patients with suicidal symptoms as well as other severe symptoms of depression, and the response can be dramatic and it can be very, very rapid within the course of hours as opposed to days or weeks. The thing is that those results, unfortunately, those outcomes are not necessarily known to be long-lived and might have to be repeated, the ketamine treatments. So basically, it doesn't mean, though, that it is not worth trying, and there are limited places that have availability. Most are still in the process of getting up and running because there is a certain degree of monitoring that has to take place for patients who are receiving ketamine treatment. It is either administered subcutaneously as injections or traditionally in the past from anesthesiology, for example, intravenously. And then there is a period of time that the patient would have to be observed afterwards. So basically, these are some of the nuances involved with the ketamine treatments that make it a little more challenging to provide, as well as some of the potential side effects that can be experienced as well. But again, it's a kind of a breakthrough treatment in rapid relief from otherwise some very, very severe symptoms of treatment-resistant depression. And it sounds like that might be an avenue that the caller might be pursuing at this time.
All right, Dr. Joseph DeLullo is our guest, a psychiatrist at Samaritan Hospital Outpatient Behavioral Health Clinic in Troy. And we will take care of one more email after the break, and then we'll hit the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. We'll be right back. It's Vox Pop Medical Monday. Ray Graff here. The guest today is a psychiatrist at Samaritan Hospital Outpatient Behavioral Health Clinic in Troy. His name is Dr. Joseph DeLullo, and you are welcome to give us a call right now, 800-348-2551. One more email. I'm not sure you could do this one, but we'll try. This is from Stacy. Stacy says, I currently have a BS in secondary education. I'd like to get into family counseling. What education degrees or licenses do I need?
Well, actually, that is, I think, dependent more on locales as well. Generally, there's licensing for being a therapist is, in general, done on state by state basis. So, basically, I would recommend to go to the Office of Education website and to look into different disciplines that and different programs that are available in education and locations of higher learning where there are different kinds of programs available. There's licensed mental health counselors. There are other programs such as in social work where a lot of people can become therapists or clinicians. There's also, of course, psychology and doctorates or doctorates in clinical psychology are other avenues to take. But there are ways to become a counselor or counselors of different kinds in which it's not necessarily only through a PhD in psychology or some other discipline. So I would say to talk to staff at the local institutions.
Dr. Joseph DeLullo is our guest today. Let's go to the phones. 800-348-2551. The number. Mike is in Clifton Park. Mike.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Hi, Mike.
Okay. Hi, my question is for the doctors. I have a older parent diagnosed with relatively mild depression, 20 milligrams Lexapro, but has had severe memory deficits within the first percentile range, and as would be expected, is forgetting to take the necessary medication. They've ruled out any other neurological disorders, and I'm wondering what you recommend for patients in that instance. She lives by herself, so someone watching her take medication or giving to her every day is not really an option. We've tried alarms and pill cases, and they're not working either.
Not an uncommon problem. Doctor.
That is not an uncommon problem, and it's actually an excellent question. The only apparatuses that I've seen are really those alarm boxes and or pill boxes. How severe, Mike, is your mom's memory lapses?
Testing was within the first percentile for a short term. On a conversational basis, we're looking at 10 minutes Okay. And it starts repeating this, the same thing. There are some things that, that stick, for lack of a better term.
Yes.
Others that, that don't. Others that are, you know, just have a conversation, half an hour later, completely forgets that they even had that conversation. I believe that she wants to take them.
Sure.
You know, when we have
sure.
the those conversations where, you know, you need to take this and, you know, all of that, you know, certainly acknowledging it, but just the follow through. And, you know, like I said, we're not there. So
right. Are there any other medications that she also has to take, or any activities of daily living that her impaired memory interfere with?
So I don't think that her memory has affected any of her ADLs to date. And that, as far as I know, the other medication that she has to take, consequently, is levothyroxine, which I'm sure will also impact her memory. But is having the same problem? Is the only two?
If she's not able to take
good health otherwise.
Right. If she's not able to take the levothyroxine, which for listeners who may not be aware is a medication that is used to replace thyroid hormone in the body and is very necessary for multiple regulatory mechanisms, metabolism within the body, that can affect your not only your thinking neurologically, but also your mood as well, and can actually worsen depression. So if no one is able to stop by on a daily basis, and this is really an issue of a reminder, the best, I think, short-term real suggestion I would have is probably if someone is able to call regularly at the same time every day, if possible. Mm-hmm. The challenge here, though, is that levothyroxine is supposed to be taken on an empty stomach, and you're not really able to take any other medications for at least another half an hour to an hour, not to mention to not eat food afterwards. So this is a really challenging situation, but I was wondering if you've tried calling at the same time, for example, every morning, and then maybe having a secondary alarm set so that she knows she can eat or take her Lexapro at that time. Has that been an option?
So we've done the phone calls. The alarms, I set the alarm to say, so that when it rings, it's not just a random alarm going off, but on her phone flashes, you know, take your Lexapro, take your levothyroxine, and, you know, try to tie it to putting next to her alarm clock, things like that. We've tried the phone calls. Done them, but we haven't seen really the results, the follow through, so to speak.
What happens while you're off?
I don't know if we've done it exactly. Well, that's it gets into another one, kind of like any parent when their child is telling them to do something. She's still a parent. I'm still her child.
Yeah, it is a classic dynamic through the ages. That is true.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, Mike.
Is there any? I know there's IV. The antidepressants are given intravenously. Are there any injectables that are given, like someone's like how birth control is done?
Not antidepressants. There's no long-acting injectable antidepressants. Those are exclusively antipsychotics and mood stabilizers. That double as mood stabilizers. So that's a great question. But in this particular case, if you can't get visiting nurse service or you know, someone else that you could possibly hire to stop by at a regular time every day, I know that could, of course, get expensive as well, but to look through with, you know, insurance, what other services they might have available as a reminder to come by to help to assist with those medication doses, that would be certainly something else I would definitely consider as well.
Mike, thank you very much for the call. Dr. Joseph DeLulo is our guest today, and let's go to Jim in Matamoros, Pennsylvania. Jim.
About 40 years ago, I got a little paperback book for about 10 cents or quarter out of the James Way, written by an MD. And it basically said most allergies have a psychological basis. Would you care to comment on that?
Most allergies have a psychological basis. Interesting. Doctor.
My comment on that is I don't think Benadryl and other allergy medications would work so well necessarily if that was the case, unless it was all psychosomatic and these were helping. I would caution that. I don't know if that was the thinking of that particular physician 40 years ago, but I don't know how rooted that is in actual medical literature that's out there. And quite frankly, I mean, I think that could be very dangerous for some people because there's certainly bee allergies, rashes, reactions to medications, reactions to foods. I don't see how that could be mediated psychologically, honestly.
All right, Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Well, we know, doctor, that just because it's in print doesn't necessarily mean it's true, but, you know.
Sure.
Jim, thank you for
and
that.
The converse
one.
Is true.
Well, you make a point. 800-348-2551 is our number. Dr. Joseph DeLulo is our guest today from Samaritan Hospital Outpatient Behavioral Health Clinic in Troy. And the number, once again, is 800-348-2551. Roger in Adams. Roger, you're on.
Hi. This may seem like an offbeat question, but I still would like to ask it.
All right.
And it is this. Have you ever thought about having more, actually, if any, political leaders with psychiatric backgrounds? I don't know of any, actually.
Interesting question.
That's a good show right there. All right, doctor, what do you think?
That is. I don't know that it would ever be, logical to have that as a premise. And I'm not sure if you meant that there should be a certain percentage that are required to have that kind of training or not. I know there are several doctors, physicians in Congress and even the Senate have been over the years.
But not psychiatrists, I don't think.
I don't think there have been any psychiatrists. I don't know that would, again, I don't know how that would change things per se, because, of course, all the political bodies have their consultants and their organizations. I think any, psychiatrist or psychologist is certainly open to running for office if they wanted to choose to do so. I think that can be a pretty demanding and stressful endeavor in and of itself, and I don't know if it's a coincidence that no psychiatrist necessarily or very few have run for office, preemptively trying to avoid that pressure and anxiety. But I think it's certainly an interesting concept, interesting thought, but I've never envisioned that.
Well, what I would like to see, frankly, is when you have a psychiatric meeting of a bunch of psychiatrists to have a discussion on it and see what comes up.
All right, fair enough. Well, Roger,
I think that's a great suggestion.
Thanks a lot, Roger, for that one. 800-348-2551 is the number. We're joined today by psychiatrist Dr. Joseph DeLulo, and Carol is in the Adirondacks. Carol.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I'm calling about a study that was done in the New York Times several weeks ago showing that postmenopausal women who had had a hysterectomy, oophorectomy, became depressed after a number of years and became dependent on alcohol and even considered suicide. Do you know of such a study?
I'm not familiar with that particular study myself. But there is evidence that the hormonal changes following hysterectomies, especially if it's also with a bilateral oophorectomy, which means a removal of the uterus and both ovaries, there are going to be hormone changes that that will basically induce a. Are you saying that the hysterectomy was performed when the patient was already
a hysterectomy was done and a oophorectomy complete, DAB, and the studies showed that women who had these operations showed signs of
depression.
Depression and alcohol dependency and need
were
to
were they premenopausal at the time
suicide.
Of the surgery?
Say it again, doctor.
I beg your pardon?
Were they premenopausal at the time of the surgery, or was the surgery performed after menopause?
They were in their 50s, and so
okay.
I assume they were postmenopausal.
So, I mean, post-hysterectomy surgery, there can be some mood effects on this. Usually, I've heard about this more or read about this more in premenopausal women. But the truth is, when you're dealing on an individual-by-individual basis, of course, different outcomes are possible. I don't know. I'm not familiar with that actual study, though, so I'm not sure if it's a cause and effect that the actual hysterectomy and oophorectomies caused or led to the depression, or if it's just an association, a mathematical association, which would suggest a possible correlation. In either case, though, it is pretty evident that when patients' hormone levels are changed, are shifted artificially as vis-a-vis by surgery or other means, that it can affect mood significantly. And hormones are some of the most, of course, powerful chemicals, that influence our bodies and our minds for that matter. And so, although I'm not familiar with the study, I absolutely have seen patients in cases where perimenopausally also, just from some of the significant physical symptoms that they might be having, it can also affect certainly their mood and their anxiety as well. So I think that's definitely an area for further study and exploration. Fortunately, even in those cases, when there are surgical reasons or chemical reasons, or we were just talking about lack of a thyroid gland or, imbalances, if possible, those hormone levels can be corrected or adjusted for, usually mood symptoms can improve. And if not, then sometimes, certainly psychotherapy could be beneficial as well. And if not adequately effective, medications meant to treat depression and anxiety as well.
Well, Carol, thank you very much for the call. We have to take a quick break here. Dr. Joseph DeLullo is our guest. He is a psychiatrist at the Samaritan Hospital Outpatient Behavioral Health Clinic in Troy. If you have a question for us, give us a call. 800-348-2551 is the number. We'll be right back. It's Vox Pop. It's Medical Monday. It's Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. We're joined today by Dr. Joseph DeLullo of Samaritan Hospital Outpatient Behavioral Health Clinic in Troy. One email here, doctor, and then we'll get back to the phones for the home stretch. This one's from Paula, and Paula's subject heading is MDMA. Paula writes, can you speak about MDMA-assisted psychotherapy? Before you do that, what is MDMA?
MDMA was originally developed in the 50s in Germany, actually, and it was meant to have been involved in anesthesia, but also for mood effects. And basically, there was a movement, I believe it was back in the 70s, 80s, on the West Coast, to utilize this substance to facilitate certain emotions during psychotherapy that would promote probably less inhibition on the part of the patient in terms of discussing different topics and with less, again, inhibition, with less what's called in psychotherapy resistance to the actual therapist.
Isn't that cheating?
Sorry?
Isn't that cheating?
Well, that was the idea there, is that it would hopefully be kind of a catalyst, you know, for the therapy to make it more efficient because, you know, depending on the degrees of resistance for different patients, and that's a great question, depending on what resistance has to be overcome, the reasons for that resistance, there can be a lot of sessions just kind of spent trying to make it to the point where the patient actually feels comfortable enough, whether it is to divulge or, you know, discuss these difficult kinds of deep innermost feelings and topics. So this, it should be noted that this is also, you know, this is a street drug as well, known as ecstasy. More recently, Molly goes by plenty of other names as well, but it's actually, you know, methylene dioxy methamphetamine. So it's a synthetic drug that was developed in a laboratory, and it alters mood and our perception of mood. This became also a popular club drug used particularly with younger teenagers and older at raves. So this became a big thing in the late 80s, 90s, I think more so in the 90s. And so, you know, and people would experience kind of a euphoric closeness, bond or sensed bond to others, love for others, but they would also get hyperthermic and literally, you know, overheat while dancing at these usually underground parties. And there were some actual deaths associated with that behavior as well. So it is a mood and perception altering substance. And the difficulty there is, and a lot of ethical questions have come out over the years as to how much leverage or artificial leverage does it then generate in the dyad of the psychotherapy. So I mean I've never actually reviewed any particular cases you know, in which it was particularly noted to be additionally helpful or extra beneficial to have this kind of assisted therapy, but it has been around in terms of the concept of it, and like I said, decades ago was actually implemented. I think though that the adverse effects far outweighed the benefits that it provided in terms of like any kind of therapeutic breakthroughs for patients, et cetera. As with anything though, I think there'll probably be your outliers. Some people may have had this experience in the past and may say that it was revolutionary for them. But again, there's as many, you know, opinions as and personal responses to things as there are people on the earth. So in terms of it becoming more widespread, I think there is a movement now in some circles to bring it back potentially, but honestly I haven't seen it up close and personal myself in terms of to warrant, you know, significant interest in trying to implement that.
Dr. Joseph DeLullo is our guest today. The number is 800-348-2551 on this Medical Monday. Gail is in Oneonta. Gail, you're on.
Yes, I was wondering if it's indicative of anything when people sob and they haven't been crying. They just, all of a sudden, they sob periodically.
Is that without sadness, Gail? Were you saying
without
just
crying? Well, they were treated for depression, and none of the medications, they reacted to the medications, couldn't take any. And they were on a medication for a long time.
Right.
We're taken off.
And you're saying sobbing, as in crying, like heavily?
You know, when you cry, they have the feeling of, or when they are breathing along, and all of a sudden they like sob, but it's not, they haven't been crying.
You mean sigh, maybe? Sighing, like taking that deep breath?
No, sobbing. I don't know how to explain what she said.
But with tears.
Without tears.
Like, without tears.
Without tears.
Okay.
That's a little confusing to me. I'm not sure if maybe she was trying to describe sighing, but was using the word sobbing, because sobbing,
I think she uses a sleep apnea machine.
Okay.
Would that be in anything to do with that, maybe? Maybe it has something to do with that.
Well, sleep apnea machines cause a continuous positive airway pressure, and that might have something to do with, again, the deep breathing, the sighing, but I'm not sure about sobbing without tears. I'm not clear on. If someone started crying or started laughing without any particular trigger at all, that's a neurological condition where the person's, you know, expression of emotions doesn't match how they actually feel internally, and that's a neurological condition called pseudobulbar affect, and I think that's probably different from what you're describing. So I'm not sure I can tell you exactly what's going on there.
All right, Gail, well, thanks for the call. Dr. Joseph DeLulo is our guest. You still happy you came on the show, Doc?
I got to tell you, everyone's really, really coming in swinging, and that's great because these are the kinds of things, these are the kinds of questions that people have, and I wish we even had more time. I could do this for hours.
Well, we'll get you back. You know, most people are on the show once, and they say, look, I've had enough of this, but if you want to come back, we'll book you again.
That sounds great.
All right, man, let's go to Laura in Colony. Laura, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm in my early 60s, and I was diagnosed with bipolar 1 in my 30s, and I have recently started to have some visual hallucinations. I'm medication compliant and have a really good team, and I was wondering if bipolar 1 could be progressive with age.
That is an absolutely excellent question, Laura. You know, it's not that it would necessarily be progressive, and really the question there also, any condition, of course, can change, right? Can shift over time, can change the degree of symptoms, the frequency, the severity, so-called breakthrough symptoms. So the nature of it can change. It doesn't have to be at 50 or 60 or 70. It can occur, you know, anywhere along the spectrum, the continuum. But I guess my question is, do you feel like your mood has been stable? And again, I just want to clarify for our listeners, bipolar 1 is a mood disorder which involves two extremes, one major depressive episodes, and the number one part of the bipolar means that there have been full manic episodes, which are pretty much described as the opposite of depression, severe excitement, which could include euphoria, but does not have to be. Euphoria could also just be significant irritability or mood lability with other clusters of symptoms. So to get back to your question, Laura, really it's when it's untreated, you can start to see different cycling of symptoms, different manifestations of symptoms, you know, frequency of onset, etc., but not necessarily. Now, these recent symptoms that you're describing, is it fair to assume you've discussed them with your treatment team already?
Yes.
Okay.
It's been intermittent, you know, infrequent, I would say.
Okay.
And also during periods where I was off my baseline.
Okay.
So,
and were there mood changes preceding these hallucinations? Was your mood not at, you know, an even kind of mood as previously?
Yes, correct.
Okay. So these are what I would just call breakthrough symptoms, what I would, at least from what I know, probably interpret as breakthrough symptoms, but not necessarily because your condition is automatically just worsening. It's variable, right? A lot of us wish, particularly treatment providers, you know, that these psychiatric diagnoses and conditions that afflict so many people that we try to care for, you know, were just static and could just be dealt with and treated effectively and completely and then be done with it, you know. But the truth is, we're humans. We're not robots or machines. And so that's where the art part of medicine kind of comes in terms of constantly having that dialogue with patients, right, with our treatment providers, and constantly having that communication in terms of if there are some developments of symptoms so that we can address those before they progress and kind of snowball. So this doesn't mean that, I mean, do you have any specific concerns regarding the emergence of these new symptoms? Like, as
we actually lost Laura there,
doctor. Oh, okay.
So that's it.
Okay.
You know, by the way, while I have this moment, just a message to people who call in. If possible, avoid the speakerphone. It sounds much better when you're on your handset. Now, if you're driving, I certainly understand. Do what you got to do. But it definitely sounds better when it's not on speakerphone. And then Zach the engineer doesn't. Well, I think Zach the engineer might need some expensive therapy here after that one. Let's go to Mark in Albany. Mark, you're on.
Yeah, hi. My name is Mark. My father is getting on in years. He's 88. He is very difficult to deal with. I would say that getting on a stubborn mule would be easier than dealing with him. I have three sisters and a brother, and we all have different ways of trying or whatever to deal with him, such as his license, he wants to still drive, and taking medications, and a healthcare provider. He still lives on his own. Is there a place we can go to get us therapy to better deal with him?
That's really a wonderful question to hear, and I think there certainly are resources available. For one thing, the National Alliance for Mental Illness is one resource that you can certainly look into in terms of for trying to see what is available locally. Because they can connect you. Albany has its own chapter as well. You can just get online on the internet and look up National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. Now, if you wanted to just pursue family therapy, I think that would be wonderful for you and your siblings as well. And again, you can look that up online for the most convenient area located for you all to explore. The truth is, I think, though, even just having conversations together as siblings and trying to establish the goals that you all have, which I'm sure some of which you all share the same goals for your dad, you know, and kind of establishing those as a framework around which to work with each of your different styles of communicating could also really just relieve a lot of stress on each of your parts individually. And as a collective siblings. So there certainly are, though, places to go. And if you wanted even to learn more about, I mean, are you guys concerned about his driving, for example, just to take one concrete
really, I mean, just everything. He's older. He doesn't take care of himself well. And,
okay.
And, like, you know, he lives in Manhattan. So I live in Albany. I have a sister that
Understood.
Lives abroad. I have a sister that lives in Brooklyn. So and
sure.
Everybody yep. has their own little, you know, way of dealing with it. One, oh, just
sure.
leave it alone. It's okay. Just let him drive for another few months and, you know, he'll get over it or his eye, you know, we are all different types of oil and water. So it's, I mean, it just doesn't, you know,
no, understood. Mike, I got to say too, this is another major universal kind of theme that comes up over and over and over for families. Is how do we help our parents, our aging parents, you know, to be safe and to make the safest decisions when they've lived a certain way for so many years. So it's challenging, but I think starting out with the goals that you guys want, and then maybe, if possible, you know, someone getting in touch with his healthcare providers to say, hey, we're not sure that our dad is driving, you know, safely. Can he get evaluated? Is there any way to get him evaluated, you know, by the DMV? That is something that is possible. They can do a test. Doesn't have to be on the road either. They can just do a driving simulator test to see how his reflexes are, et cetera. He still lives on his own, so he's holding on to that independence. Now, for other options and just purely informational reasons, you might consider seeing an elder care attorney. Not because you're looking to pull the rug out from under your father or anything, or try to, you know, assume control over his, you know, estate or anything like that. But in terms of trying to just see what the options are, and they would have a wealth of resources as well in order for you guys to approach some of these very, very difficult topics, you know, at later in life. So I would also encourage you to look, and you don't have to do it down there. You know, Manhattan, you can, up here there are some fine elder care attorneys as well who could kind of just meet, you know, for a consultation or something, or initially over the phone, let them know your circumstances. And just in terms of to see what your options are and even dealing with your siblings, how you could all go about it to communicate better.
All right, Mark, thank you for the call. Well, Dr. DeLulo, you've made it through an entire program. Thank you, sir, for being here. And if you really can take
it. It was a pleasure. Flew by, Ray.
We'll have you again. Thank you very much for being here. We really appreciate
it. I look forward to it, and thanks for the opportunity.
You betcha. Support comes from Dr. Jean Chen, specializing in endoscopic spine surgery and disc regeneration, treating disc herniations, spinal stenosis, and myelopathy. envisionspinesurgery.com for details. Once again, thanks to Dr. Joseph DeLulo for joining us today on the line. Thank you for calling. Sorry if we didn't get to your calls. You know, this guy will come back. He was a popular guest. And thanks to Zach, our engineer, who handled everything with aplomb today. There were a couple of noisy calls. You did very well. Kayleen White took the calls. Our producer's Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, get your hammer. Get your screwdriver. Get some rivets. It's Home Improvement with Darren Tracy. That's tomorrow at 2. Right now, stand by for the Media Project.